Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime analyst on A&E Network's police documentary show, Live PD. Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole had a law enforcement career that has spanned over 32 years. She was an FBI agent and profiler who has worked on several notorious cases. Since her retirement, Mary Ellen has become a published author and continues to consult when called upon. Mary Ellen O'Toole, welcome to PD Stories.
Thank you very much.
Tell me how you got into law enforcement.
Oh, sure. So I've always had an interest in a specific area of law enforcement, and I go back to the age of about five when I had a very distinctive interest in homicides and why people killed other people, and more specifically, what was going through their head while they were actually killing somebody. And I know that sounds very macabre, and I'm sure that was very frightening to my family, but I found it curious in a very, scientific way, in just in terms of how does this behavior happen and why does it happen and what does it look like. And once I started to develop that interest, frankly, it's never gone away. So that really took me into an academic career of psychology and then mental health counseling. And then it was after graduate school I decided that my calling was really in law enforcement. And my first job after that was with the San Francisco District Attorney's Office for about 4.5 years. And then I was accepted into the FBI.
Were you one of the first women to become an FBI agent?
No, I wasn't one of the first women, and that's because right after the death of J. Edgar Hoover, which would have been in 1972, the FBI began hiring women as agents, and I came in the FBI in 1981. So during that time, they had a handful of women, not very many, because even in my class, I think I only had five women that out of a class of about 50 prospective agents. So I was sort of one of the first ones, but certainly I didn't have that distinction of being, the first group of women that came in.
Now, you got a master's degree in counseling. How did that help you when you got into profiling?
I do have a master's degree in rehabilitation counseling, and my design was to either work in a prison, work in a mental health facility, work in a women's center. And I actually did all of those things as part of my internships. And I loved the whole area of counseling and listening to people. But once I got that degree, I decided I cannot function. I cannot work as a professional counselor. I have to go into law enforcement. The pathway was so clear to me. That bright light was so shiny, it almost was overwhelming.
Now, was anyone else in your family ever in law enforcement?
Yes, they were. My father was an FBI agent for a number of years and actually worked for J. Edgar Hoover. My mother also worked as a secretary for the FBI for a number of years, and at times she would actually be flown up from central Illinois to Chicago at J. Edgar Hoover's request and act as his personal secretary, so she knew him well. My brother was a San Francisco police officer. My brother-in-law was an FBI agent for 28 years, and then followed by me, who was an FBI agent for 28 years and a senior investigator with the San Francisco District Attorney's Office for nearly 5 years.
Wow, that is quite an FBI family legacy right there.
I think you're right. It really is a legacy, and until somebody asks me that question, I don't quite think about it. So when people ask me about why I went into law enforcement, I really have to stop and say, I think it could have been in my familial DNA to do this.
That is, I did not expect that. That's really, really interesting. And your mom being a secretary for J. Edgar Hoover is just, that's pretty phenomenal.
Yes, I actually have a picture of J. Edgar Hoover. It's actually a drawing, and it's signed to my mother, and it says, from J. Edgar to Isabel Murphy, which was my mother's maiden name. And I find that interesting because my mother always talked extremely highly of J. Edgar Hoover. She liked him a lot. She would never tell me about the cases that she worked on, but she talked about how well that he treated her. So when we found that picture and all of her belongings after she died, I grabbed onto that because I thought that picture was really quite important to my mother because of her relationship with Hoover.
Now, you are the first FBI agent to come on PD Stories. Tell us what it's like as a career path to get into the FBI. And I kind of have a little insight because I applied to the FBI when I was a senior in high school in 1975 and got a letter back from J. Edgar Hoover telling me I need to get a college degree first. And so I did. But I never applied to the FBI after I graduated. So tell me and tell our audience what your path was like to get into the FBI.
Sure. My path to the FBI was, I think it was interesting and it was very educational. Right after I got out of graduate school, I moved to San Francisco and I started to work for the San Francisco Police Department and then ultimately was hired by the San Francisco District Attorney's Office to work as an investigator in their, what was called at the time, career criminal program. And we, my partner and I, worked with cases involving serious lifetime offenders, whether it was robbery, burglary, homicide. So I had a lot of good experience doing that for about 4.5 years. And during that time, several FBI agents came over to testify in one of my bank robbery cases. And they talked with me about the FBI, but I already knew a lot about it. And I already knew that's what I wanted to do because I had applied right out of graduate school, but I was told I was too young. So when they came over and said, hey, would you try again? I was like, yeah, I'll try. That's really what I want to do. So I applied. The process took about a year, which is pretty typical. I was accepted after all the stages of the application process, including a long background investigation, which everyone goes through. And I landed back at the FBI Academy at Quantico for a 4.5-5 month FBI New Agent Academy experience. Passed that and then got assigned to my first FBI field office, and that was San Francisco.
Now, tell me about the FBI Academy itself, going through the Academy, what that entails.
Going through the FBI Academy, at least for me, was extremely challenging, and I really think it was for everybody. And the reason I say that is you cannot fail when you go through. So, for example, the Academy is broken down into three major sections. You have your academics, you have firearms training, and then you have defensive tactics, at least when I went through. And academically, you can only get 1 C on a test. If you get more than 1 C, they would send you home. That was the end of your FBI career. And you had to score and be proficient on firearms, and the same with your defensive tactics. So there was just a lot of pressure for everybody to really excel in their performance in all three areas. But it was the most, I guess, inspirational experience to be able to go through the academy and know that, you know, you were one of, you know, very few people who were chosen, and you were going to have this incredibly exciting career ahead of you. And everybody was really passionate about becoming an FBI agent. We, as a class, there were several classes going through. Class sizes are about 40. So we became very close, and everyone committed to making sure everybody finished, and we did. And it was just one of those most astonishing feelings of success once you actually were handed your credentials by the director of the FBI that said, you are now officially an FBI special agent because you worked really hard and I worked really hard to get those FBI credentials.
Now, where was your first field office assignment and what did you do?
My first assignment, I was sent back to San Francisco, California, and that's where I had come in from because I was working in San Francisco. So I went home, which was really good for me. Initially, I was assigned to work with a senior agent he was working on the organized crime squad. So I worked really under him as he mentored me in terms of FBI paperwork, you know, where the bathrooms were, where the kitchens were. I mean, it was a huge building, and you had to really learn from ground zero everything about how the San Francisco FBI worked. And I worked with him for about 3 months, and then I got assigned to my own squad, which was so exciting because that was the Violent Crime Squad. And as a member of that squad, we worked every violent crime that happened in within the jurisdiction of the FBI San Francisco. So from the middle part of the state, just about all the way up to the Oregon border, we worked crimes like many bank robberies. We worked extortions. We worked kidnappings, which meant you went out, you were called out in the middle of the night. You made arrests. You interviewed people. You testified in court. You did surveillances. So, you know, we were out in the thick of things, constantly involved in every type of violent crime you can imagine.
What was your most challenging investigation during that period of your career in San Francisco?
Probably the most challenging crimes were the crimes that were very long, that were very lengthy, and those would have been the kidnappings and the extortion cases, because they would go on for a long time. The bank robberies were probably the most dangerous, because you were going into a bank that had just been robbed and you're encountering people that were quite dangerous. But I think for me, it was the crimes that went on, like the kidnappings, because you would spend days, if not weeks, involved in those cases. And they were very sensitive cases. And they were very risky, just in terms of what could happen to the victim and then your involvement in the case. So there wasn't just one specific case when I worked on that violent crime squad. As I became a much more experienced agent and got more involved in the profiling aspect of the FBI, then my personal involvement in the cases became, I think, a lot more memorable to me, just in terms of events and cases and people that stood out to me.
During that time in San Francisco, did you ever get into any situations that were actually where you had to draw your weapon?
I recall one occasion when I had to do that, and you never really want to have to, and certainly you never want to have to use it, and I never did. So the one time that I did have to pull it, it was my case, and my violent crime squad and I were going out on my case to arrest what was a bank robber, but he also happened to be a serial killer. But we didn't really know that at the time. It was only right about the time we were making the arrest. So I see him walking down the street, and at some point we're getting his rap sheet, where, you know, the forensics are coming in, and I become aware that, I mean, it's dangerous enough for him that he's a bank robber, but then he's also got these other offenses in his criminal history that he's a suspect in. And so the man was very compliant with me. He was very polite. He let me put the handcuffs on him. I put them on probably wrong, because they pinched him. And he said, "Wow, those hurt." And I apologized. I said, "I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to do that." So I loosened them up and helped him get into the back of the car. So I'm not sure what message I sent to him. I was with other people, and I was a newer agent, so they were very helpful. But it was stressful when we had to do that, because when you pull your weapon, the way you're trained is that you may have to use it. So you don't pull a weapon casually. And I knew that at the time. So I was very, very grateful that it ended up the way that it did.
And he turned out to be a serial killer after the fact?
Well, yes, he was a suspect in a series of homicide cases. And we learned that pretty close to the time that we had brought him in on the bank robbery case. But I didn't know that at the time. And would that have affected what we had done? I don't know that it would have. Certainly it would have elevated his dangerousness level. But being a bank robber, you know, made him dangerous as it was. But this certainly was one of those moments after the fact that you say, oh my goodness gracious, this man was even possibly more dangerous than what we thought he was.
Wow. When you were part of the Violent Crime Squad, tell me about some of those cases you worked on.
I was assigned a fugitive case while on the Violent Crime Squad in San Francisco. And the fugitive, in his criminal background, which was pretty extensive, at one point he had served time in Alcatraz, the prison right in the San Francisco Bay, which has always been very notorious and well known for the types of offenders that were that had been incarcerated there. So, in working on this case, my husband at the time, I had mentioned the case to him because he was in law enforcement as well, that I was working for on this case and I was looking for this individual. He was a fugitive. And I mentioned the man's name, and John was just stunned when I told him the name of the individual, and he wanted me to repeat it. And he just sort of looked at me in a very weird way, and he said, "Wait a second. Do you remember when I told you I was in a shootout with this guy, some guy years ago, and we were driving up the freeway, and this man was shooting at us," meaning my ex-husband and his partners, and we were shooting back at him. And I said, "Yes, I remember you telling me that." He said, "That's your fugitive." And I thought, oh my gosh, that means that we're talking about a pretty dangerous person here. I don't know. I never found him. And I don't know whatever happened to him. I don't know if because of his age that he had already died by the time he became a fugitive that I started to look for him or the FBI started to look for him. But I just remember hearing that story and thinking, man, this is going to be a dangerous guy if we are able to locate him.
You know, when people think about organized crime, they immediately think New York or Chicago. What was the nature of most organized crime in San Francisco?
From a proliferate like position with gangs like the Hells Angels. So when we would have raids on the West Coast involving biker gangs, then all of the agents in the San Francisco office would be involved in going out and serving search warrants or making arrests and transporting members of biker gangs back to the federal courthouse. And so I was involved in that as well. So there's obviously a pretty big difference between those two. But the fact that they were violent and that they were organized and they were involved in criminal behavior was very much a part of how those gangs operated. Yes, they were dissimilar from the kinds of organized crime gangs on the East Coast, but we would take leads on those types of organized crime cases as well. So if New York had an investigation on, let's say, a mafia ring in New York, they would send a lead out to San Francisco if they needed some investigation done, and we would cover that lead for them. But we did have a different type of organized crime investigation in San Francisco.
Now, once you'd done 15 years as an agent, you moved into becoming an FBI profiler. How did that come about?
Right. The way I became and moved into the role of an FBI profiler was not particularly remarkable. I had indicated while I was in San Francisco FBI that I was really interested in this new program the FBI had called profiling, which probably was because of my mental health background and my interest anyway. So I had started to shadow the senior agent in San Francisco who was in charge of the profiling program in the San Francisco division. Every FBI field office had an agent who was called the profile coordinator. And that agent worked with the profilers who were all located back at the FBI Academy. And they would liaison with local law enforcement and identify cases that needed profiling assistance and then collect those files and send them back to Quantico. And I shadowed that person for several years, and I received training from the FBI profilers located back at the FBI Academy, and I just continued and continued. And the more I was involved in it, working with local law enforcement, I would get called up to work homicide cases with local law enforcement or agents in the office who would have an interview with someone that they didn't feel comfortable interviewing. It may be someone that they thought was a little bit odd or different, they would call me on the phone and say, hey, you want to do this interview? I would be like, yeah, I'll do it. So I sort of developed this reputation as being someone who was very willing and able to get involved in more unusual, sometimes aberrant, cases, serial murder cases, cases involving sexual deviancy. And I would work 24/7 because those were the cases where I think I found my ability to be the most productive and effective. And that's how I developed a reputation. And then slowly I was able to turn that into really a full-time position within the San Francisco FBI.
Did you have any involvement with the notorious Zodiac Killer case?
I did have involvement in that case from two perspectives. While I was still working in San Francisco as the profile coordinator, I was contacted by several detectives who had taken over the case for all of law enforcement in Northern California. And they asked me to help them develop a personality assessment on a possible suspect. And so I met with them numerous times. We talked about the case. We talked about where we were in the investigation or where they were in the investigation, why this person they identified was a suspect, and then what this person was like, and developing his kind of his personality and his background and his habits and his lifestyle so that those detectives could actually go in, sit down, and talk to this individual in order to determine whether or not he seemed like a likely suspect for Zodiac, a case we've still never solved. But unfortunately, that suspect had passed away before we were really ever able to conduct an interview with him.
Now, as a profiler, when you actually have to go to a crime scene, what is your role? Where do you begin?
When I would go to a crime scene, I would initially make contact with either the FBI agent who requested that I come out to the scene or the police department that requested me. And I would sit down with that individual or those individuals that were in charge of the investigation, and they would give me an overview of what the case was. If it was a serial murder case, they would provide an overview of each of the cases, where they were in the investigation, the status of the forensic evidence, and then that could take hours, it could take days, depending on the number of crimes we were discussing. And then we would go to the crime scene. It's important as a profiler you see where the crime occurred. It's important because you want to know, how did the offender get in the neighborhood? How did they get out of the neighborhood? How were they able to access the victim? Who could have possibly seen them? How has the neighborhood changed since the crime occurred? So I would spend hours, if not days, just walking around the crime scene, trying to get a better sense of the area where the crime occurred. Now, keep in mind, when the profiler, or when I would go to the crime scene, it could be days, but more likely weeks, months, or years after the crime occurred. So you're not there when the first responders are there. So you're not getting involved in all of that activity. It's after the fact that we go there. But when I would go to the crime scenes, that was after I would review pages, sometimes thousands of pages of investigative files, so that when I landed on the ground, I already had a pretty good idea of where the case was and what it was about, so that I could talk about the cases with the investigators. But again, I would always sit down with them to listen to them in terms of what was going on, and followed by the crime scene. Then I would sometimes meet with the medical examiner, if it was a homicide, to find out more about the damage to the victim, the type of weapon, what the medical examiner could say about the wound pattern. And then I would get a briefing on all the forensic evidences, what was collected, what was processed, and what were the results of the processing. So it was a lot of work. And then finally, generally what they wanted when they had a profiler come in to town, they wanted to, for you to, after you were able to do all of that, whether it took a day or 3 days, then they wanted you to sit down and give you their opinion, your opinion on what you thought the offender was like, why the offender committed the crimes, what the motivation was, you know, what the post-mortem, post-offense behavior was. So you were expected to sit down and give them a briefing on what you concluded. And that was very difficult because there was always a lot of pressure on the profiler to be able to articulate how they synthesized all that information.
Tell me about one of the most intriguing cases that you successfully profiled working with your colleagues.
I would say that for me, one of the most interesting cases was a case involving a sexual sadist. And a sexual sadist is a very specific kind of offender, a very rare offender. The case out of New Mexico, the call came into my office on a Friday night, and it was a call from an agent in the field office who said, here's the fact pattern. We found a victim has been reported walking down a rural road naked except for a collar around her neck, and she claimed to have been kidnapped by a couple, a man and a woman, and kept over the weekend and tortured. And the victim herself had a high-risk background, so she was involved in prostitution. So there was a question about her veracity and whether or not this was this story she was telling was actually occurred or if it was something else. So my FBI partner and I decided that this was the type of case where we needed to go out to the scene and be on the ground to make an assessment in real time, which is what we did. And when we got out there to this rural part of New Mexico, I met with the prosecutor, the evidence response team, all the investigators. And they said, on the property where this allegedly took place, there are some things we don't understand. And one of them is a U-Haul storage area where there's a lot of very bizarre items. And we can't figure out what that means and what that says about the offender. So Tom, my partner, and I went in with the evidence response team into this U-Haul trailer that was equipped from top to bottom with chains and ropes and handmade dildos and notes on the wall and pictures on the wall. And in the center of the U-Haul storage area was a gynecological chair that had been wired up with clips and all sorts of really torture equipment. So as soon as we walked in, we both knew exactly what we were talking about that with this kind of an offender. There was just so much material there, so much equipment there to tell us that the offender in this case, who I was just about ready to go and interview, was a sexual sadist, and these were the trappings of someone who was engaged in sexual sadism, which is the most extreme paraphilic behavior that we dealt with in the BAU.
Tell me about the interview, the first time you sat down to talk to this sadist.
The first time I sat down to talk to the individual who was involved in this crime, and who was even self-admittedly a sexual sadist. It was pointed out to me that he had asked to meet me. He wanted to meet the female profiler that had traveled out from Quantico. This was a very small little country jail, and which means there was very minimal security. And as I sat in the waiting room, I looked down a long hallway, and I saw walking down this hallway a very tall, thin man wearing shackles, and he had handcuffs on. But he was really more, so he's scooching down the hallway with the deputy who was escorting him. But he had a very he actually had a very kind face. And when he reached me, he shook my hand, but he actually took my hand in both of his hands. And he said, "Oh, Mary Ellen, it is so nice to meet you. Please have a seat. Can I get you anything to drink? Would you like a coffee or a soda?" And I'm thinking to myself, buddy, this is a jail. This isn't your living room. And you don't really have control over refreshments or where I sit. But at the same time, it made sense to me because this was someone who, in my professional opinion, had manifested traits of a psychopath. And psychopathic individuals tend to be very glib and extremely charming people when you meet him. And that's exactly how he treated me. And after that time, I had the chance to talk with him on multiple occasions. And he was really one of the nicest offenders, one of the most charming offenders I had ever had the opportunity to talk to.
Did you get any sense of why his sexual behavior evolved to that particular extreme violent area of gratification?
I knew theoretically already how that behavior develops, but I also talked with him about it over a period of time. He was actually reticent about explaining it in a way that was theoretically correct. So he would talk about how he had, as a young boy, viewed pornographic material, and that contributed to his violent fantasies. But it was far more than just looking at pornographic material. And I would explain to him that what we knew about paraphilic behaviors, particularly the extreme one, sexual sadism, is that it develops at an early age, and it's learned behavior, again, at an early age. But he never was able to look me in the eye and explain to me what happened to him as a little boy that caused him to become sexually aroused by torturing women, which is what sexual sadism is. It's becoming sexually aroused by the victim's response to the infliction of physical or emotional pain. He knew what he was, and he admitted to what he was, but I was never able to get him in to completely talk about how he actually became that way.
Wow. And did you get a sense from talking to this suspect, at what point in his torture of a person would he say, "Okay, it's now time for me to kill this person"?
Oh, no, I never saw that. And the reason, having worked other sexually sadistic cases, a sexual sadist, they will kidnap someone, and they spend days, weeks, months, if not years, torturing them. So, frankly, they will tell you they invest a lot of time in getting the perfect victim and then having the right place to take them so that they can engage in this kind of aberrant behavior. So they don't intentionally kill their victims. Their victims may die because of how terrible they're being treated, but they don't specifically intend to or specifically engage in behavior to kill them. They don't want that to happen. They want their victims to be with them for a long period of time. At one point, this individual that we're talking about had convinced his quote-unquote friend to lure the friend's wife ultimately into what was referred to as the toy box. The torture chamber's name was the toy box. And what David would do would be to use a particular type of drug on his victims. It would not kill them. It would not even cause them to go completely unconscious. It would put them into sort of a twilight state. And it's my recollection that that's what happened to this wife. And he had her there for a prolonged period of time. But because of the awful ways that he would torture his victims. She was close to death. And then the husband came in and completed murdering his own wife. And then they disposed of the body.
Repeat that. Let me get this straight. He kidnapped his friend's wife, put her in a torture box, and tortured her for 2 days.
David didn't really kidnap her, although I suppose technically or legally that would have been the case. David's friend brought the wife over to the house, and at some point the wife was drugged and then was taken into the toy box or the torture chamber. And then David began to torture her. So she was actually somebody that he knew.
So they were sort of complicit in this kinky, bizarre behavior.
They were. He had a circle of friends that were somewhat aware of what he was capable of and what he would do. And it was interesting to me that his circle of friends were significantly younger than him. And many of them used drugs and alcohol. David, however, simply did not. He wanted to be clear-minded, and he simply did not use drugs or alcohol. And that made sense to me because these friends of his could certainly have compromised him because they did not have the self-control that David did. So they would go with him at times, but their ability to recall details and facts, and he never confided in them completely because I think he really understood that they were young, they were engaged in risky behavior with the drugs and alcohol, and they could compromise him. So while they were sort of his friends, they were just they were not people that really knew what his true capabilities were. He would never let them into that to see that secret side of him.
Wow. That is truly, truly chilling and bizarre. Yeah, you worked on a very interesting child abduction case. Tell me about that.
The case that comes to mind that I found to be quite interesting was a child abduction case that I worked right before I transferred back to Quantico. And this involved the abduction of 12-year-old Polly Kloss out of her home in October of 1995. And it was actually Polly's abduction that initiated some of the earliest legislation that we've seen on child abduction cases. The way this case happened was really quite interesting. She was at home in her family home, and her mom and her little sister were in the home as well, and she was having a sleepover with two of her friends. It was 10 o'clock at night in a nice neighborhood, and there were people in homes all around her. And as her friends are with Polly, and they're laughing and joking and having a good time, someone comes into the bedroom and really zeroes right in on Polly and indicates to the three girls that he was specifically interested in her. And the two girls who we talked to afterwards did not report that this individual, the kidnapper, seemed to be drunk or on drugs, but actually very much in control of his behavior and what he had said. And again, Polly's mother and her sister were in the room sleeping right next door. It was a very small house. So the offender actually, after having a very brief conversation with the three girls, he had the two witnesses put pillowcases on their head, if I recall correctly, and then count to like 1,000. And he basically took and walked Polly out of her bedroom. And the girls did what they were told, and they counted to 1,000. And then they then they decided something wasn't quite right, but they weren't sure. They're also only 12 years old. So this was extremely bizarre to them. Initially, they told us they thought it was a joke. And they went and got Polly's mother, and they woke her up, and they said, here's what's happened. And then at that point, she calls the police, and the investigation ensues. But it was a very unusual beginning to a tragic kidnapping that culminated 2 months later when we found little Polly's body about 100 miles away up north in Northern California.
That abductor turned out to be Richard Allen Davis, if I recall correctly.
The kidnapper in this case was Richard Allen Davis, yes. When Richard was finally identified as the suspect in this case, he was brought into the police department, and I remember when he walked in the door, escorted by two deputies that walked him into the interview room because I could watch it from another room. And I was very impressed, once again, by how normal Richard looked. At the time, he was a very handsome man, and he walked in, and he walked in very casually. He didn't appear to be stressed. He didn't to appear to be anxious, angry, combative. And he sat down at the interview table with another FBI agent and the detective that was in charge of this case. And as you watch this, the dynamics between these three men, if you didn't know, it would have been very difficult for a stranger to point out who was the agent, who was the detective, and who was the kidnapper. Because Richard just acted like he was part of the investigative team. He laughed, and he joked, and he had engaged in conversation. He was a very charming and engaging man. And you had to sit there and really watch that and keep telling yourself, that's the kidnapper. And at some point during the interview, which went on for some time, I mean, he was manipulative and played games with the interviewers, but at some point during the interview, he said that he would take law enforcement to the location where he had left Polly. And I always found that remarkable because I think we all felt that had he not agreed to do that, and he did later that evening, that's exactly what he did, and we found Polly's remains. But had he not done that, I cannot tell you that we would have found Polly, at least at a point where we could have recovered the type of evidence that we did. So his taking us to her, her body, still to this day, surprises me.
I got to know Mark Kloss, Polly's father, very well. We were involved with the search for her at America's Most Wanted when she was still missing. And I got to know him very well. Him and John Walsh became very, very close allies and advocates in the fight for tougher sentences for child offenders and sex offenders and so forth. And just an extraordinary man. He went on to this day, he continues to fight for the rights of children and to punish offenders of children.
Mark has done a phenomenal job with his foundation, the Kloss Foundation, and he is, you know, absolutely one of the strongest advocates, not just for Polly, but for other children who have been kidnapped. And he has worked really tirelessly from that point on to help other families that have had to go through this nightmare, and not only helped with, you know, physically going to families that are going through a child abduction case, but helping them with resources and helping them with, how to navigate through one of these cases. So he's really used his grief, his tragedy and his grief to help other people. And I think that says a tremendous amount about him and his entire family and how they really absolutely love that little girl.
Now, you worked on the infamous Green River Killer case.
I did work on the Green River serial murder case. And more specifically, I participated in ongoing interviews with Gary Ridgway after he was arrested, with the purpose being for him to take us to the remains of most of his victims. At the time Gary was arrested back in 2001, we had the remains of five victims whose bodies had been recovered from the Green River up in Seattle, Washington. But we had many, many other women that had simply gone missing and their bodies had never been recovered. So the district attorney in King County, Washington, had worked with Gary's defense attorneys and Gary and agreed to take the death penalty off the table if Gary would take investigators to the remains of the victims that he had murdered over a course of years in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and many of us think even in the early 2000s. So the purpose was, based on the request of the family, is talk to this guy, talk to Gary, and identify the locations where he disposed of the bodies of our loved ones and bring them home to us. But that process took 6 months of interviewing. Gary was a very difficult person to interview. But during that time, I had the opportunity to spend hours with him and talking about his murders, talking about how he developed in his mind, and talk about why he did what he did to the victims. So I would, in looking back on that and looking back on being able to participate in this case, it was probably one of the most memorable cases in my FBI career.
He was the rarest, one of the rarest types of deviants. He was a necrophiliac, correct? And that's a person who wants to have sex with a corpse.
So are you going to be shocked if I tell you that necrophilia is not really as rare as you think it is, at least in my world? Is that too much information?
No. This is why we're having this conversation, so we can learn these fascinating things that you know.
With some of these serial sexual killers, necrophilia is part of the reason that some of them engage in the murder itself. Yes, it's rare, but it still occurs, and it's unique. And when you begin talking to an offender who does engage in this type of behavior, as an interviewer, my colleagues and I would always have to be very careful about not sounding disgusted or shocked once they tried to tell you that part of the reason they committed these murders was so that they could go back and actually sexually assault the corpse. But there are other famous serial killers that did engage in necrophilia as well, and one of those was Ted Bundy, who's always remains as one of the poster kids of serial murder. A good-looking college graduate, wanted to go to law school and was ultimately arrested for a series of murders, but he also engaged in necrophilic behavior with some of his victims. So it is something that we have seen over over time, and we can usually determine that if we're able to get to the remains of the victim soon enough. But for example, in the case of Gary Ridgway, the victim's remains were outside and stayed outside for decades. And so the interviews that we did with him had to involve getting him to tell us that that's what he did. And I think that's part of the reason it took such a long time. We could not tell that from the forensic evidence, because most of the forensic evidence, if not the majority of it, was destroyed because of the length of time the remains were outside.
And, you know, it's amazing. I worked on so many cases over 18 years with America's Most Wanted, and we had cases where we had people that had different deviant behaviors. There was one I remember where there's a group of people who want to become amputees because they believe that having a limb amputated will make them sexy, and there are people who want to actually have sex with amputees. And we had a case where there was a doctor from Chicago who was willing, under the table, to go to Tijuana and have people from this deviant subculture come to Tijuana to have a leg amputated from below the knee or an arm so that they could fulfill their sexual reincarnation as an amputee. It was the most bizarre thing. I mean, have you heard? You've heard of things like this, right?
I have never myself had a case like that, but I've consulted on cases where the individual actually wanted to be killed and then have their body consumed for sexual gratification, and I'm not sure how that would have happened if you're dead. But so the really bizarre, unusual kinds of sexual deviance, like the amputee and being murdered and being consumed by someone else, they're extremely, extremely rare. Are they out there? Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, people don't know just how many different types of mental deviant criminal sickness there are, do they?
Psychopathic individuals are people with a personality disorder. Psychopathy is not a mental illness. What's important to underscore is that the majority of psychopaths are not violent, and the research that's been done on this disorder over the last 40 or 50 years is incredibly solid, and it has identified traits of psychopathy that cluster together so that even if we're talking about an individual who is psychopathic and living in let's say, Seoul, South Korea, or South America, or in Ireland, they're going to have and manifest the same traits all over the world. So there are these universal personality traits, which is very helpful from an investigative standpoint. Some of the traits include such behavior as this. They're pathological liars. Psychopaths will lie about anything, even if the issue they're lying about has nothing to do with the case or the crime, which makes interviewing them very difficult. Psychopathic individuals, when you first meet them, are extremely charming, and so it causes people around them to lower their guard and see them as not threatening. These are people that tend to be very extroverted. They have no guilt or remorse for what they do. They're huge risk takers, and they're highly impulsive. But psychopathic individuals can be the head of a major company, even the head of an agency. They can work in jobs that are very, very appealing to psychopaths, like jobs that involve a lot of power and control. And again, most are not violent. But even if they're not violent, they still, because of this cluster of traits, they tend to live on the edge. And if they have to engage in violence, if it's necessary for what they see as their self-preservation, they don't have a problem in stepping over into the world of violence.
It's interesting. During the hunt for Andrew Cunanan that summer, I went to Stark, Florida, to the prison there, to death row, to interview another guy who had been a traveling gay serial killer named Gary Ray Bowles. I actually interviewed him at Stark Death Row, and I'll never forget
how
normal and charming and likable he was. I went there anticipating, you know, someone who was somewhat of a monster. He had killed 6 people up and down the East Coast and killed them all in different ways. He would just use whatever was handy to murder you, beat you to death with a lamp or hit you in the head with a frying pan or whatever it was. He would just go into a rage and kill some gay guy he picked up at a bar and rob him. And I was just fascinated by how normal Gary Ray Bowles seemed. And I walked out of there really conflicted, feeling like, you know, in a different life, I think I could have been friends with that guy. But
wow.
I know, you know what I'm saying, right?
I do.
These people are so charming and normal that it just, and he told me matter-of-factly how he killed each person. He wasn't one of those people on death row who denied that he'd murdered anyone and he was innocent and railroaded by the prosecutor. He was very, very honest about his crimes. But it really just, I've told people this story many times, that when you actually meet a serial killer face-to-face, you'll be shocked at how normal that person seems.
So when you were engaged in a conversation with this person and you're actually looking at him and he's looking back at you, did he ever give you that look? It's called snake eyes or dead eyes, and it means the offender's eyes sort of drop to half mast and all the color and the light go out of their eyes, and now that their eyes become very sharp and very focused and very black. And when that happens, that's when usually because you've asked them a question or said something to them that they don't like, or you've done something that they don't like. And at that point, they're looking at you through the lens of the prey-predator relationship. They're the predator and you're the prey. Did you ever get that look?
When we were talking about his childhood and his mother.
Oh,
and the men, that the various men that his mother brought in and out of his life, some who abused him, some who beat him badly. And that when we talked about that, he did kind of glaze into some sort of strange look.
When I was teaching my classes at the FBI, especially the National Academy classes, where the students all were sworn law enforcement and had worked as police officers for many years, I would ask them how many had ever met a psychopath. The response initially was they weren't sure because they didn't know exactly what I was talking about. But then I would describe for them, you're talking with a person who literally makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And when I said that, then they got it. Then they would look at me and they would all say, yeah, I've had that experience. It's been pretty frightening. And usually they would also include that they felt that type of fear when they looked into their snake eyes, those dead eyes that we were just talking about.
Tell me about the relationship between FBI agents and local law enforcement. And I know a little bit about this myself, having worked with FBI on many, many major cases with AMW and working with local law enforcement on joint task forces with the FBI. But tell me from your perspective. We see in the movies that the local police are at the scene. They've got this big crime. And then the FBI agents come in and say, we're taking over this case. And the local police, you know, Denzel Washington or whoever it is, they're all upset at the FBI and the FBI come in. Tell us how that really works.
So from my perspective, in working with many, many law enforcement agencies internationally and domestically, the relationship between the FBI and state and local law enforcement is really quite good. So the characterization of the FBI coming in on a case-by-case basis and taking the case away from local law enforcement. It's happened in the past. It's terrible when it does happen. But in my 28 years as an FBI agent, and again, interacting with so many law enforcement departments throughout the country, the relationships that we've had with them are really quite good. They're very effective. We worked very well together, and I personally didn't have those kinds of problems whatsoever. And the other agents that I worked with, that I typically would travel with, they were of the same mind. We would go out to be of assistance and to help, but not to take over. So I think that kind of relationship that the movies sort of underscore, that you've seen with an arrogant FBI agent coming in and really creating a rift between agencies, that really has to do with the personality of a single agent as opposed to really the philosophy of the FBI. And nowadays, there are so many joint task forces that have been created throughout the country. If you walked into a FBI field office or a police department, it would be very difficult for an outsider to look at the men and women sitting around that table and say, well, those two are FBI and those two are from the state police and those two are from the sheriff's department, because we all work together, because we know how important it is to work together as a team.
So it really is more Hollywood than reality. Do you have any perspectives on the Las Vegas shooter, the gambler who opened fire on the concert and killed all of almost 50 people, I think, and wounded 500? Do you have? We don't know to this day why he did what he did. He had a good life. He was worth several million dollars. He gambled for a living. He had a beautiful girlfriend, a couple of houses. There seemed to be nothing in this man's life that would point you to, I'm going to get a suite at the Mandalay and turn it into a killing nest. I'm sure you've thought about this since this happened as a profiler, right?
Yes, I have thought about the shooting and Stephen Paddock, the suspect or the offender in that case. And in my opinion, based on how he carried out that crime, which is based obviously on public source information, he was able to successfully maintain a secret life where he was able to plan in great detail what he was going to do, to the exclusion even of his girlfriend with whom he was living. And there was so much detailed, deliberate effort in putting that plan together that it contributed to the development of a sort of a personality type with him. His crime itself was elaborate. It was very arrogant. It was very cold, very callous. The victims were strangers to him. He didn't know who these people were. Again, from the crime scene behavior, it begins to suggest to me that this was a psychopathic crime scene. And in other words, the crime scene committed by someone who has these psychopathic traits. Going back to what are the traits of a psychopath? They're cold-blooded. They're without empathy. People are just objects to them. They dehumanize their victims, which is what I saw in the Las Vegas shooting crime scene.
I'm always fascinated by what makes one mass shooter decide he's going to survive this crime and face justice as opposed to the one who decides to die either by their own hand at the scene or in a shootout with the police.
It's a fascinating question, and I don't have a specific answer to it, but I do think the events of a mass shooting are so unpredictable for the shooter that while they think in their minds before it happens how they would like to see it played out, that they cannot be sure exactly how the events will unfold. So, for example, the police arrive sooner than what they anticipated, or a victim responds to the shooting and tries to interact with the shooter. But I do think, too, that with younger shooters, the way that they plan it out is far less sophisticated than someone that is an older shooter, and that goes to their level of maturity. So, for example, with Stephen Braddock, he had a longer opportunity to think through how he was going to end his crime, but some shooters just don't have that opportunity. So the ending comes in a much more spontaneous manner than maybe the original plans.
Are there things that haunt you from time to time that you saw during your career? I know for me, when I was with America's Most Wanted, I dealt with I've been to crime scenes and homicide scenes and seen many, many photos from crime scenes and interviewed many, many victims. And it took me a while in the first few years to really get it in perspective. You know, when you're standing in a freezer where a bunch of employees have been laid down and shot in the head and the coagulated blood is all over the floor, mixing with the smell of rotted vegetables. And it took me a while to get to where I could do the job without it going home with me. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, do you have any of that?
I would say that I've never been haunted by things that I did on the job or by things that I saw or the type of work that I did. I love the work. I love the cases. I love the constant go that was involved, going to the scenes, interacting with law enforcement, seeing cases through to the end. And I really love the responsibility that it involved, and actually the kind of life and death decisions that all the agents that I worked with and I had to make. I really enjoyed that, and I felt like I was ready to take on that challenge. So sometimes I equate that to people that work in an emergency room doing the kind of work that they do. I don't know how in the world they do that, but when you talk to them, they love it. It doesn't depress them. They go back every day, challenged to do even better the next day. And that's how I always felt about my job. And I never stopped thinking about the cases, but not in terms of them taking a toll on me, but in terms of, how did that happen? What did I miss? How could we go back and take a different look at it? So it was constantly trying to move forward with cases and learn more about offender behavior. It was never in a sense of being haunted by the work or by the behavior of some of these really violent offenders.
My last question is, since you retired, you've been pretty busy still. You still work as a consultant to police departments. You still assist with cases.
I do still work. I do still consult on cases, and I actually went back to work full-time, and I'm currently the director of the Forensic Science Program at George Mason University in Fairfax, where I have about 300 students, many of whom want to graduate and go on to become FBI profilers. So I'm sort of back in my world again. And I love it. And my students just want to be out there and work the crime scenes, work in a forensic lab. But I know all of them want the same experience and rewarding career that I have. So I'm very fortunate to now be able to help shape some careers that can make a difference in the years to come.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for sharing your career and your insights with us. And I wish you all the best in all of your endeavors in retirement and in continuing to work at George Mason in forensics.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr. Don't forget to watch me every Friday and Saturday night on Live PD on A&E at 9 o'clock. PD Stories is an A&E production produced in association with Audio Boom. PD Stories is executive produced and created by Sue Funk for A&E Networks.